In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In 1381, thousands of men and women surged into London, attacking jails, burning down palaces, murdering the Archbishop of Canterbury in the Tower of London, and confronting King Richard II. So what was the cause of their fury? And how did their actions change the course of English history? Well, Spencer Mizzen sat down with the medieval historian Helen Carr to discuss everything you wanted to know about the Peasants' Revolt. As usual in this series, our questions are drawn from popular internet search queries and those that you've submitted via social media.
Right, I'm joined today by Helen Carr, a writer, historian and producer specialising in medieval history and public history. Helen's books include The Red Prince, John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, and What is History Now?, which she wrote with Susanna Lipscomb. And her production credits include history documentaries for everyone from BBC Two to CNN. Helen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. Helen, one of the most popular search engine questions is a fairly basic one, and that is, what was the Peasants' Revolt? I know this is a fairly hefty topic to cover, but I wonder whether, in the space of a few minutes, you could give us a quick overview of the Peasants' Revolt before we drill down into the uprising in more detail.
Sure. Well, the Peasants' Revolt is such a fascinating event that took place in June 1381. And I think what is so fascinating about it is it's been so misrepresented, and it's so little, until fairly recently is truly known about it. And its name in itself is down to that. So the Rising, as I generally prefer to call it, was given the rather unfair moniker of the Peasants' Revolt by the historian John Richard Green in his 1874 short history of the English people. And the term Peasants' Revolt really doesn't do it justice, because it really does represent a misconception of this sort of conglomeration of pitchfork-wielding peasants, which really wasn't the case. But it began not in 1381, it began earlier in Northampton in a parliament in 1380, which was held in November, at which point a poll tax of 12 pence per adult was introduced, being the third poll tax in 4 years. And being taxed like that was really an impossible situation for the poor, because they were charged as much as the rich. And this resulted in a large-scale tax avoidance. And then things got ugly when commissioners of inquiry were dispatched around the country to enforce payment. And some of these people demonstrated violence and even sexual violence until people fought back. So around the end of May, collectors in Essex were attacked with bows and arrows. And in early June, a meeting was held in Essex where rebels vowed that they would destroy divers lieges of the king and his common laws and all lordship. So basically to say that they were going to try and destroy this hierarchy. And similarly, Kent rebels met in Dartford and they held the same sort of meeting, and then rebellion spread through Essex into Suffolk and Hertfordshire, Cambridgeshire, areas around the country. The most famous factions were the Essex insurgents and the Kent insurgents, and that's because they had sympathies with each other and they created a sort of partnership. And in early June, both parties marched on London and went via Canterbury, but also Rochester Castle, where they freed prisoners from the jail there and kidnapped Constable Sir John Newton. And they also, possibly even just with pure purpose, released a man called John Belling. And then they all arrived in London at Blackheath on the 11th of June, on the eve of Corpus Christi, a very important religious day. And then the next day, the King, Richard II, said he would meet with them, and he sailed from the Tower of London, where he was staying at this point, for his safety. And he was supposed to speak with them from a boat at Rotherhithe. But when the scale of the rising was spotted, with, you know, up to sort of 100,000 rebels, his barge was turned around and it fled back up river to the Tower. This angered the rebels, and that's when the real destruction began. They entered the city over London Bridge. They stormed Fleet Prison, the Round Church, and various wealthy properties. But it was the next day, on the 13th of June, they did the most damage to the Savoy Palace, which was the home of John of Gaunt, the king's uncle. And that was described as the fairest manor in the kingdom, and that was completely destroyed. So Richard knew he had to meet with the rebels, so he arranged another parley at Mile End, where he went to hear their terms. And when he went to do this, he left the Archbishop Simon Sudbury and the Chancellor Robert Hales inside the Tower of London, because they were, according to the rebels, instigators of the oppression. And this was actually ended up being a bit of a death sentence, because a sort of separate group of rebels got into the Tower and they rather barbarically executed both men on Tower Hill. And then this was followed by a bit of a killing spree. London was a pretty dangerous place to be at that stage, until on the 15th of June, when everything ended. Richard met the rebels again at Smithfield. And this time there was a dispute between the rebel leader, Wat Tyler, who we're going to talk about later, and a valet in the king's retinue. The fight broke out between them, and Wat Tyler was killed. Richard then famously rode out in front of all the rebels. He quelled the rebellion and the rebels disbanded, but not without consequences.
Thank you, Helen. That was a really good summary of what sounds like a pretty turbulent period in English history. Now, I want to turn to a couple of questions now. The first one is from Andrea H., which was submitted on Twitter, and that is, should the Peasants' Revolt be connected with the Black Death? And then I also want to put another question to you, which was submitted on Instagram by SBH2004. And that is, were the peasants united by a shared ideal, or were they driven by desperation? So I guess we could boil these two queries down to one question. And that is, what were the main causes of the peasants' revolt? What drove thousands of people to march on London and vent their fury on the nobility, the church, and the king himself?
Yeah, they're both good questions, and they're certainly both accurate. It was certainly to do with the Black Death. I mean, the revolt took place in a post-Black Death economy. It had a massive impact on the economy. In 1349, as a result of the Black Death, the Ordinance of Labourers was introduced by then King Edward III. This was introduced in order to regulate the rapidly rising cost of labour. If you think about the amount of people who died in the Black Death, you're talking to 50, some sources say even up to 60% of people, largely labouring classes. So you've got all these landowners who are relying on these labourers to work for a reasonably cheap fee to generate income off their land and their property. So when that workforce is depleted by 50%, that's going to cause a massive problem, 50% if not more. So there's this huge rising cost in labour. And these surviving labourers tried to gain higher wages for their services. So this ordinance was introduced to put a cap on these wages, and it was really meant to sort of push down certain classes from attempting to use these circumstances quite rightly, to better themselves. And it, you know, it wasn't just about wages. It was even putting a cap on the way people could dress. It was all about regulating hierarchy, because people, because of the massive death toll, people were able to rise up the ranks in such a way that it was making the wealthy feel uncomfortable and threatened.
There was more social mobility at the time then.
Well, they were trying to hinder this sense of social mobility, but yes, there was, because people were able to charge more for their services, which is why there was such a massive decrease in serfdom at this point. So then a few decades later, under the new king, the boy king, Richard II, poor, who had been forced to remain poor, were taxed for the third time in 4 years. You know, it was raised to 3 groats for anybody over the age of 15. And these taxes were imposed due to a constant threat of war, and the French were attacking the English coastline. So that was used as a reason for the increase, but it also angered the people. And there was also this overwhelming belief that the king's government was corrupt. Richard II was served by a continuous council. So it was elected members, elected councillors who were set up in order to assist him in his minority, but they were generally pretty unpopular with the people. And when the taxes were raised, initially, Robert Hales, who was the treasurer, wanted the tax to be split into two, so it was easier for people to pay. But the money was rolling in too slowly, so they decided, no, we're not going to do that. We're just going to go for one big hit. And these commissioners of inquiry were pretty brutal. And there's accounts of some of them actually checking girls' virginities to see if they were old enough to be paying tax, you know, because they could have sworn that they were under the age of 15. So it was people were treated pretty savagely. So in answer to the second question, yes, people were pushed into action.
Hamish Ross on Twitter, he asked, was replacing the king, Richard II, an object of the revolt? So, I mean, yeah, I just wonder if you give us a quick explanation of what the rebels hoped to achieve via the revolt.
They never wanted to replace Richard. It was really the officials and the government officials and the family members around Richard that they had the issues with. So here particularly his uncle, John of Gaunt, the Chancellor, Archbishop Simon Sudbury, the Treasurer, Robert Hales. These were all people that they saw were the instigators of their oppression rather than the king himself. They believed that the king was young. He was a boy king. It was still believed that he was divinely appointed by God. So therefore they didn't have the issue with him, but they wanted his counselors to be removed. And that's really a trope of the medieval period. It wasn't ever really so much of an issue with the king. It was all of the resentment and rage was always placed on the king's counselors and the men that he kept around him rather than the king himself. He was kind of the innocent victim in all of this and like a pawn to be moved around. But it was the counselors and those who were advising him who were the targets really for the rebels. And ultimately they wanted fair treatment. What Tyler said, that all men should be free. They wanted liberty, equality, the banishment of serfdom and fair tax. And a major demand was the abolition of labour and other services for holding land and their replacement by flat rate rents. And, you know, it's important to say that the rebels included not, you know, they weren't just serfs. They were tenants with land and goods and abilities. And they had their own sort of, yes, limited, but they did, some of them did have their own wealth. You know, they held manorial offices. And so they had aspirations. So the frustration really was at the demands made on them by the sort of landlords, you know, the lords above them. Again, it was this, yeah, I suppose it was this antagonism amongst the hierarchy.
Your answer there just leads us on perfectly to the next question, which was submitted by Natasha Lavender on Facebook. She asked, why is it called the Peasants' Revolt? As you've hinted, those involved in the uprisings may not have all come from what we'd like to call them the rebels' peasants. How accurate is that?
I mean, there were some peasants, but I think what its moniker has done is given us an image of it being exclusively peasants. So it's people who were, you know, living amongst the filth who have suddenly risen up with their pitchforks against the lords who were sat up in their castles. And that's not That's not untrue, but what it isn't doing is factoring in the whole of the sort of middle class, as you might call it. So I think that it is an unfair moniker, although there are accounts. So, for example, Thomas Walsingham, who was attached to, he was based in St. Albans, called them a conglomeration of plebeians, which I always think is quite a funny phrase. But there are other records which would describe the revolt more like a sort of rising in a warlike fashion. And it was a real combination of people, you know, about 60,000 farmers, the low order clergy. So you had also, you know, you had people like parish priests, roofers, Wat Tyler being one of them, reeves, bailiffs, men and women. It was a real mix of people. And importantly as well, there was also a significant amount of ex-soldiers. So men who had served in France during the Hundred Years' War, who were no longer being paid for their services, they came back and they were involved in the revolt as well. So it really is a complete mixture of people who are getting involved in it. But as I said as well, there were also tenants. You know, these are people, skilled labourers. So it wasn't really a case of it being peasants. I think I would probably describe it more as a mixture of middle orders and people often who are very skilled, and they had their own businesses, they had their own setups. You know, it wasn't a case of these people being so poor that they were literally scrimping off the land. I think it was a real combination. I mean, there were those people as well, but it was not exclusively peasants.
Now, you've mentioned the name Wat Tyler a couple of times, and that's a name that would be familiar to many students of history. And that leads me to one of the questions I got here, which is a very popular internet search query, and that is, who was the leader of the Peasants' Revolt? So I wonder if you could start off by introducing us a little bit to Wat Tyler, but also could you tell us about his fellow leaders who may not be as familiar to the people listening to this podcast?
So we don't really know much about Wat Tyler other than his direct involvement with the Peasants' Revolt and his rather grisly death at the very end of it. But we do know that he was from Essex and that he emerged as a leader of the revolt, particularly the Essex faction, quite early on, and that he was a Tyler of houses, hence his surname. So he was literally Wat the Tyler. So that's really all we know about Wat Tyler, but he was also accompanied by John Ball, who was a priest of minor orders. And his role really was to give these rather electrifying sermons. So he really got everybody buoyed up and geared up. He was a leveling presence. So he was against the nobility. He didn't believe that there should be a disparity in people due to their, you know, their birthright and their wealth and status. The idea of a social hierarchy was abhorrent to somebody like him. And he said, there be no villains, not gentlemen. The lords be no greater masters than we be. So, as I said, he's really leveling the people.
So would you see that as quite a modern perspective and sort of ahead of his time a little bit?
Yeah, he was ahead of his time, because so much of the societal infrastructure of this period was around social hierarchy. That was really how everything was put together. You had this very clear order of things, of the order of which people fit into, to the point where, when I'm going back to the ordinance of labourers and various statutes that were put in place, that people couldn't even dress beyond their social status. I mean, he's kind of questioning the whole thing. Then, you know, obviously he makes reference to the Bible, and there's this famous quote that's always associated with the Peasants' Revolt, which is, you know, when Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? And that was really the point of John Ball. Another figure that people might have heard of is a man called Jack Straw. And Jack Straw he's a shady one, because we're not actually even sure if he existed. Like, it's possible that he was there was another leader, but there's no evidence to really say that he was a clear person within the revolt. As opposed to Wat Tyler, it was very clear that he was a person who led this faction of rebels. But Jack Straw's been this sort of mystical figure that's sort of been associated, but we've never really kind of actually, there's not actually any real evidence to say he existed.
What do we know about Wat Tyler's final moments?
Poor Wat Tyler. So it was all rather unfortunate. So it was at the very end of the Peasants' Revolt when Richard met with Tyler at Smithfield, and Tyler was representing this, you know, giant horde of rebels who were across the field at Smithfield, and Richard was with his retinue. He had this entourage with him. And what Tyler did is he was, you know, he was thirsty. It was hot. He had been marching. It was, you know, he probably hadn't eaten or drunk very much. And he asked for a cup of water, and he was given some water, and he swilled water around his mouth to sort of wash his mouth, and he spat the water out in front of the king. This caused some of the more snobbish members of Richard's retinue to reprimand Tyler, because they saw it as a cuss against the king. To sort of spit at the out this water in front of the king was an act of offence. And so they got into an argument, they started to bicker, and then a fight broke out. And what Tyler, it's really uncertain exactly how he died. Some sources say that he was beheaded, others say that he was just stabbed and then he was dragged off the field. But he was then killed by the mayor of London, and that sort of basically ended the revolt, the death of the leader. But this was all happening, if you're sort of standing from the perspective of the rebels, this was all happening quite far away and people couldn't really see what was going on.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
They were hung, drawn and quartered. Some heads were displayed on London Bridge. And particularly in Essex, there was a rather savage pacification, and there's accounts of people being hung from trees.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So is there any indication that his death was pre-planned, or do you think it was more spontaneous than that? Or is that pure speculation? Do we not know either way?
I think it was pretty convenient for Richard, and I think it was pretty convenient for the nobility who were there. I don't know if it was necessarily pre-planned, but I think that it had certainly been an accepted ending. I think that there was no way they were going to just let the leaders of this revolt walk off the field unreprimanded. There was always going to be a consequence to this.
And so you'd say without its figurehead, was the uprising always doomed to failure after that moment, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it was almost a bit of a Pied Piper of Hamelin situation, and they just sort of cut off the head of the Pied Piper. Not that I'm trying to compare all of these rebels who were there for a very good reason to rats, but it's just more of a case of, you know, with the figurehead cut off, they didn't really know what to do. And it was a moment of, this could either go dramatically wrong for Richard and for the nobility, and there would be a battle. Because of the number disparity, the rebels would have won that battle. So Richard took his, you know, it was a very conscious move, it was a brave move for the young king, but he rode out in front of them and he confronted them as their king. They weren't going to respect any of his, you know, the nobility around him. They weren't going to respect any member of his retinue. They hated them. But for Richard, he was this divinely appointed boy king who they saw as this sort of slightly glowing young boy who was their savior. It was really what their opinion was of him. So when he rode forward and he addressed them as their king and promised to hear their grievances and said, "Oh, I hear you. I will make sure that all of these terms are arranged. You will have your freedom." So he told them what they wanted to hear, because ultimately he needed them to leave. And that was the point. So that's what he did, just really to buy him time.
So quite a lot of our internet search queries are related to Richard, wanting to know who the king was during the revolt. My question is, and you've kind of touched upon this already, is how would you rate his performance during the revolt? And what did the revolt do to his standing among the nobility and the people more generally?
So for Richard, the Peasants' Revolt was a really critical and important event in his kingship. And I think it was the moment he went from his minority to acting as king. I think that that moment when he went and stood in front of the rebels at Smithfield, I think was the moment he realised his own kingship and he realised the power that he had and he was able to wield. I think it went to his head very much. I think before that he had been a bit of a mummy's boy. His mother, Joan of Kent, was a very strong figure in his life. He's very close to his mother. He had been living under the shadow of his father, the Black Prince, who was a very warlike man. His grandfather, Edward, who was also very warlike, and Richard wasn't really. But what he did have from a very early age was this sense of superiority and this sense of divine right. And so when he could see that he was able to exercise that without the very leveling presence of his uncle, John of Gaunt, without any of his counselors who were advising him against doing so. This was done, you know, off his own back. He was demonstrating his own autonomy. I think that it was the moment where he went from boyhood into, you know, quote unquote, manhood. And it was after this that he started to fall out with his uncle and he started to demonstrate a sense of his regality and kingship, and he started to make his own decisions.
Do you think, or is there any way of knowing from the sources whether he felt any sympathy for the rebels?
No. No, he definitely...
Short answer, no.
When he was chasing them down in Essex and hanging them from trees and stuff, I didn't really see any sympathy there. I think he was pretty clear about how he wanted them to be treated.
Okay, so now I want to turn to a question that we had submitted on Twitter from NLK, and that is, what were the after effects of the revolt on John of Gaunt, who we've mentioned a couple of times in the interview already? So John of Gaunt seems to have been a real hate figure for the peasants. Why was that? And what happened to him after the rebellion?
Yeah, oh my goodness. The rebellion was huge for John of Gaunt, like massive, as massive as it was for Richard, although on a more negative level. It was like Richard kind of had his moment of glory, whereas John of Gaunt was sort of knocked down a peg or two. So John of Gaunt wasn't actually there during the Peasants' Revolt, luckily for him. He was up in Berwick on Tweed and he was negotiating with the Scots, which was something that he did regularly. He was used a lot on these diplomatic exercises up in Scotland. He was a hate figure for the rebels it goes back quite a long time. It goes back to the Good Parliament, which took place in 1376, while his father was still alive. And John of Gaunt really was the figurehead of this parliament, which was... he was forced to hear a lot of grievances from the commons, which resulted in a sort of purging of royal government. And at this point, there was a lot of corrupt officials who were, you know, kicked out of government. But then John of Gaunt became particularly unpopular because later on, he actually kind of put them back in place. So people didn't like that. He also fell out with the church, particularly with the Bishop of London. So the people of London particularly did not like John of Gaunt. He was incredibly unpopular. He was also unpopular because he was self-titled King of Spain by right of his wife, Constance of Castile. So he had this palace, the Savoy Palace, which I mentioned earlier, that was filled with Spaniards, and he was calling himself king. And it was very confusing for people, and people didn't respond favorably to that. In fact, during the revolt, there was a chant that was allegedly shouted, which was, "We will have no king named John." So there was maybe this rumor, an overriding fear that he was going to usurp Richard being, you know, his young nephew. I mean, that just falls again. It's just another sort of trope of medieval England, isn't it? The evil uncle kicking out his nephew and taking his place. So there was that fear. What was the result of this for John of Gaunt? Well, it was pretty catastrophic. He had his main seat of power completely destroyed. The Savoy Palace was broken into. All of his belongings were destroyed in a pyre that they built in the Great Hall. Gaunt, because he was trying to get over to Castile, he was constantly mustering arms to lead a campaign into Castile. His brother had just was preparing to leave. So he was actually storing gunpowder in the Savoy Palace at the time, which is, you get where I'm going here. These barrels of gunpowder were ignited. I don't believe they knew that there was gunpowder inside these barrels, but that was the result of the Savoy Palace basically being worse hit and worse destroyed than any other building in London, because they did actually roll these barrels onto the pyre that they had ignited in the hall. Yeah, so he lost his palace, the Savoy, which was the main seat of Lancastrian power. I mean, this went way back to Edmund Crouch back. So this was like a kind of, it was a generational property, and I think that was a huge blow for him, and he never rebuilt it. And that's significant, the fact that he never rebuilt it. We also see a total 180 in his character after the Peasants' Revolt. Another reason he was unpopular was that he had a mistress called Catherine Swinford, who he had a very blatant love affair with, and people didn't like that, particularly the church. So he ended that relationship quite quickly after the revolt, and he seemed to go all pious, and he basically was very apologetic and very humbled. And he really stayed away as much as he could from court politics. And his whole focus, his attention just turned towards Castile. And his interest was in going to try and gain his seat in Castile, his kingship in Castile. And I think that he didn't really want much to do with English politics at this stage. And he spent a lot of time up in Scotland for Richard on behalf of the king and negotiating truces up there on the borders.
He kind of made himself scarce then from London after.
More scarce, yeah. He just, every time he went to London, it was problematic.
Okay, now Anne Maloney on Facebook asks, what role did women play in the Peasants' Revolt? So I don't think we've mentioned one woman yet in this chat. I mean, what influence did they have on the uprising?
Yeah, women were involved in the uprising. So women certainly went along, and they were in London, and they were part of the mass of rebels. They were part of the number. They were involved as both victims and oppressors. So as victims, there's an example of if we're looking outside of London, because the revolt happened across the country, there was a prioress in the Benedictine convent in Carrow, which was in just outside of Norwich. And she was called Margaret de Eng or de Ing. And on the 18th of June, so this is slightly after revolt in London has ended, this was when, you know, there were pockets of rebellions happening across the country. The main one happened in London, and then you sort of saw these mini uprisings happen elsewhere. She came into contact with a band of rebels led by some men, Geoffrey Lister, a man called John de Trunch. And they were on route to Great Yarmouth. And around the same time, there was another group of rebels, but these were tenants of nearby Wroxham Manor. And they attacked the priory, and they were led by a man called Adam Smith and Henry Stanford. And in both of these men leading tenants from Wroxham. So it's a bit confusing because the manor was owned by the priory. So there was obviously some kind of disagreement going on between the priory and the manor. But anyway, they used the revolt as an opportunity to threaten the priory and threaten those who live there. So they threatened Margaret with death. It was quite extreme and must have been terrifying for her. What they wanted her to do was give them the deeds in the court rolls of the priory, which were probably containing information about their roles within the manor or payments or something like that. So there must have been some kind of evidence within that they didn't want that to exist. So they burned these documents. So women were targeted elsewhere as well. And I imagine, you know, because it was violent, I'm sure that women were victims of that violence. There was also, I suppose, the Queen Mother, who, there's quite a funny story that when the rebels broke into the Tower of London, they went up to her bedroom and she was in there. And this is because there's other sources that say she wasn't there. So then allegedly they went in and sat on her bed and gave her a kiss. And it was so traumatic for her, she fainted. So there's that story as well. But then there's also a woman called Joanna Ferrer, who was led this group of insurgents into the Tower of London. And it was under her orders that the Archbishop Simon Sudbury and Robert Hales were dragged out of the tower and executed. So there's a few examples of different roles that women played within the revolt. But I definitely recommend, there's a great source if people really want to look into the detail of the real individuals that were part of this revolt. And this is where information such about Margaret of in Carrow comes from, and it's a source called The People of 1381, and it's a new project that was completed, I believe, last year. And there's loads of information on there and anecdotes about all these different people who weren't just necessarily the nobility who were involved in the revolt. So I'd recommend that as a point of reference.
Darth Muller on Twitter wants to know, why did the rebels slaughter foreigners in London?
Yeah, this is a good question, because London was a pretty multicultural city. I mean, as it is today, you know, as a centre for trade. There's lots going on. There's a busy port, which, you know, you've obviously got loads of different people from different nationalities coming into the port and staying in London. But from a more domestic point of view, it was quite ghettoised in certain places. And there's a particular reference in the Peasants' Revolt, which is where this question will come from, that the Flemish were subject to brutality. And the example that is often referred to, particularly in the case of the Peasants' Revolt, was a horrible scenario that took place with a group of Flemish people. So the rebels went into the Flemish ghetto. So this would be around the King's Cross kind of Farringdon area, North London area. So a group of people were pushed inside a church. Doors were closed. They were barred. And the church was torched. So it killed everybody inside.
That's quite a grim episode, isn't it, in the uprising?
Yeah, that's a point of the uprising where, you know, the point of it is overturned. It becomes really an opportunity for vandalism and cruelty and brutality and mob rage rather than with an agenda to do good, which was what I do believe it was set out to do. And I believe that the leaders of it maintained that to an extent. Obviously, not so much when they're chopping off the head of the Archbishop of Canterbury. It was meant to do good, and that obviously was not at all. Why was this? And the only thing that I can really put this down to was bigotry that is still demonstrated today. And these sort of fraction of Flemish were unpopular. That's possibly due to wealth, possibly due to disagreement over trade networks. I'm not entirely sure what the vindication was, but I believe that it was a sort of bigoted attack.
That incident obviously occurred in London. The main kind of landmark milestone moments of the revolt, most of them seem to have occurred in London, but wasn't only in the capital, was it? I mean, Gareth Taylor on Facebook asks, was just wondering about the geography of the revolt. Is that fair? I mean, were other parts of England and even, well, Scotland and Ireland at all affected?
Yeah, it definitely did happen elsewhere in the country. And there was a rumour of a band of 10,000 rebels or something marching north to remove John of Gaunt from the borders and drag him back down south. So it was definitely, it was snowballing. There were pockets of rebellions in minor towns and villages around the country, but it was, I don't think there's much evidence of it being in the far north. There was fear in Pontefract Castle of rebels coming and attacking the castle there. But it seemed to be that there was more of a resounding fear of rebellion and revolt kind of escalating throughout the country. So as far as I'm aware, and there will be more research on this elsewhere, but as far as the sort of aspects of the revolt that I have worked on, there was certainly a fear in cities around the country towards the north that the revolt was coming, but it never really reached them. So, for example, Leicester, the people of Leicester armed themselves. They mustered up on Gartry Hill in Leicester, and they waited for the rebels to arrive, but no, nobody ever did. But the rebellion really was at its strongest in the southeast, pushing into sort of East Anglia territory as well, but less so in the north. I could be wrong. There may have been some small scale rebellions elsewhere, but they were pretty quickly put out. There was none that really sort of were striking. There is a great example, though, of the Bishop of Norwich, who, when there was some rebels in Norwich who were using the rebellion to embark on their own escapades, that he apparently took up arms and terrified the rebels by gnashing his teeth like a great boar. And he had like two swords or something and managed to sort of quell the rebellion pretty quickly. So I quite like that example. But yeah, so that's what I mean about all of these little kind of pockets of rebellions. But there wasn't anything quite to the extent of what happened in London, no.
So as you mentioned, the uprising was ultimately put down. What was the authorities' response over the following months or years? How brutal was their revenge?
It's a real sort of pacification. So the rebels that could be caught were caught and they were executed. They were hung, drawn, quartered. Some heads were displayed on London Bridge. And in Essex in particular, there was a rather savage pacification. And there was accounts of people being hung from trees. As their part of being involved in the revolt. So the point was proved by the authority that they didn't want this to happen again. There was no way this was going to be allowed to happen again. But I do think that there was some progression made through the revolt in itself. You know, no poll tax was levied again for almost 300 years. And it's possible that there was a significant impact on the decline of practices like serfdom. But there's been such a legacy that has been left by the revolt as well. Well into the next century, it was referenced. And Jack, there was this, that's where I think the mythical figure of Jack Straw comes into play.
Here's a question from Mary Samvig on social media. And this is kind of a related question. She asks, after all was said and done, was anything accomplished? Now, you've kind of already answered that question to a degree, but how did it change the country? How was England a different place after the revolt as compared to how it was before?
Certainly in the latter years of Richard's reign, so, you know, leading up to 1399, there was, well, as I've already said, no poll tax was levied again. So that's pretty significant. But there was fear of uprising. So, I mean, my expertise is obviously John of Gaunt, and there's evidence of if there was any inclination of an unsettled environment, he was pretty quick to leave. So he often went places wearing a breastplate underneath his clothes. There was a deliberate effort to de-escalate any kind of social tension in those years. But I think the major impact I've probably kind of covered in that, you know, the fact that you've got a tax being raised three times in 4 years, and then it's not raised again at all for 300 years goes to show that there was a fear of the same thing happening again. And there were future revolts. There were future revolts in the next century, for sure. This wasn't kind of the last quote unquote peasants' revolt that took place, but it's definitely the one that has the lasting legacy that it does.
And finally, Helen, here's a question from MHFQ on Instagram. They ask, how have interpretations of the peasants' revolt changed over the years?
Well, I think it went from a pretty punitive account of it being these filthy, vengeful, bloodthirsty serfs who all they could, you know, who anything they could get their hands on, be it a pitchfork or a sword, they would use that to basically just watch the world burn. And I think it's gone from that where the nobility and the, you know, the elite were victims of the revolt, to there being a much more balanced view on what the rebellion was all about. So if you read some of the earlier, more sort of antiquarian historians' accounts of the revolt, it was very much like this, that these these peasants, quote unquote, were sort of meant to be quite, you should be fearful of these characters. They were almost a caricature. Whereas today I mentioned this fantastic database, which the people of 1381, you can actually go and see who these people were who were involved in the revolt. And that really does shed a level of humanity to it. And I think that that is how I would say interpretations have changed, that it's become its whole moniker, the Peasants' Revolt, has become less believable. It's being taken with a pinch of salt, and people are starting to see that actually maybe there was purpose and reasonable reason for this uprising, and maybe good came of it and good was intended from it, and it wasn't just a case of bloodthirsty revenge.
That was the medieval historian and broadcaster Helen Carr. Helen's most recent book is a biography of the medieval power broker John of Gaunt, and it's called The Red Prince. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.